Don't you know?
Places.
Don't you know?
Events.
Don't you know?
From the campus of Winona State University, KQAL-FM is proud to present...
Don't you know?
Now, here with Everything Winona, here's Terry Tenseth.
Oh, don't you know?
Today we visit with Dan Basor, who is a world-renowned fishing lore expert and collector. He owns one of the world's largest fishing tackle collections, and his collection is on display at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. It's called Hooked, Historic Fishing Lures, and can be seen from May 18th through September 4th. Dan has been collecting for more than 50 years and continues to search the globe for the best and most unusual fishing collectibles. Following the interview are some selections from the lecture he gave back on May 23rd. There's some great stories about the history of the different lures, and although it might not be traditional to listen to it on the radio, Dan is such a great storyteller, we thought we'd go ahead and bring you those excerpts from the lecture. He really knows how to drive home a visual concept, and I'm sure you'll find it very entertaining. You're listening to Don't You Know on KQAL.
Hi, I'm Dan Basor. I'm here with the exhibit Hooked at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, and it's fabulous the way it's been displayed. We are very excited to be here. We have items that go all the way back 8,000 years ago to the early copper culture. Then we have items that are prehistorical that were dredged up around Alaska around 1,000 years ago, and then items that were brought to America by the early immigrants from Europe. Some of them were made by jewelers, and they're just fabulous in their construction. We go all the way through with many, many other exhibits of items made in America.
And where are you calling home right now?
My home since 1982 is in a forest preserve in Warrenville, Illinois. We have a lake right there that we manage as a children's catch and release educational pond. So our hands are full with that. Anyone that manages a body of water knows that you're always working to make sure that they have an optimal experience and catch fish and have fun, and we can just about guarantee that.
What got you started collecting all these lures?
Well, I was a collector almost by birth, started collecting coins, and that's back when you could go to the bank and get a bag of quarters or dimes or nickels and pennies and go through them and find some really good dates and some silver coins, and the banks started wising up to that. And sometime around the middle 1950s, you couldn't go down and get those bags of coins anymore. Unfortunately, my grandfather died in 1957, and to my knowledge, he didn't fish. But we found in his basement a tackle box of lures that were absolutely new in the box. I think someday when he retired, he was going to go fishing. That was his idea, but he hadn't. Now, these lures were neat. They were still new in the box. They were older lures. And I thought, well, I can't collect coins anymore like I used to. And people were already collecting guns, knives, duck decoys, things of that nature. But to my knowledge, nobody collected fishing lures. And to me, they're as artistic as any of those other items. So I started to collect fishing lures. And all my extra money from delivering newspapers, shoveling snow, raking leaves, mowing yards. I even had a vegetable stand. I would sell greeting cards and things of that nature. All that money went into old fishing lures.
So when did you decide that you were going to start displaying the lures or taking them on?
Very soon. One of the other jobs I had was at a local boat dealership where I'd go work after school, you know, clean boats, do whatever needed to be done to make a few dollars, and I asked him if I could put a little display in the boat store with a sign, wanted more old fishing items. And that started working out, and that winter they had a sports show, and I said, could I take my little display to the sports show? And it was a real hit there, and people would bring in tackle boxes, and back then you could buy a whole tackle box of old lures for $10. And they'd laugh at you because they were obsolete, but I loved them. And so I started exhibiting early on. And we've done a number of museum exhibits now, and some people will say, maybe they're drug along by someone else saying, let's go see this fishing exhibit. And they'll go, oh geez, what's in that? And those are the people that are hardest to drag away. I mean, some of the ladies, they see the lures that are made by jewelers, and they, my goodness, and the paint patterns, and the creativity, and the thought behind it. Some of the greatest American art, to me, are displayed in some of these lures. And some of it is like folk art. We'll have things by a man they call the Rat Man, Bud Stewart. And he has lures that are covered with muskrat fur or lures that just any odd parts he'd find around, a shoe spoon, he might make a lip for the bait or whatever. I love that. I love the early copper culture items that are the earliest fishing items made in America that are on display. I love the early European lures. I love the pre-1900 lures made in America. But even some of the more modern ones, the colors on them, some of them have up to 17 coats of paint, and the depth of their colors and the creativity. There's a glass minnow tube where 1893, they said, put a minnow inside, fish it all day, and at the end of the day, release the minnow back to the waters from whence it came with thanks for the capital sport it provided. What a joke. I mean, but, you know, you cast it out and break it. That's why they're so rare and hard to find. There's the nifty minnow made here in Minnesota in 1915. And I found the advertising flyer for it. It's made in many different sizes, many different colors, according to the brochure. We haven't found those other colors. Maybe someone will come in and has something like that. The hunt's always on. We'll never, ever know it all, but we keep trying.
How have you gone about finding the history of the different lures?
Well, one of my most influential teachers was a Mr. Shaw, my history teacher in high school. He'd served on General Eisenhower's staff, and I really got a love for the history. So to me, as soon as I find something, I want to know all about it. And I document that and write a fishing history column in Midwest Outdoors, which is the largest selling outdoor publication in the Midwest. And we've been doing that now for about 26 years, 12 articles, of course, a year. So someday we're going to pull those together and they'll be in a book.
What part of the collection is your favorite and why?
I'm asked that quite often. What's your favorite lure? And I fished tournaments. I was one of the very first members of the Bass Angler Sportsman Society. In fact, I just was down 3 weeks ago and fished with Ray Scott, its founder, and we're old friends. One of the things I learned early on was not to have a favorite lure because you get locked into it. You need to be adaptable, and that's really carried through with my collection. I liken it to a musician. You couldn't say, what's your favorite note? You know, and I can't say what my favorite lure is. I love them all.
Where's your favorite place to go fishing?
My favorite place to go fishing is, it's always changing. I love the Copper Canyon. In fact, I wrote an article in a national magazine last March about the beautiful Copper Canyon in Mexico. It's three times bigger than the Grand Canyon. You can take a train trip from sea level in Las Mochas, Mexico, up to 8,000 feet through 86 tunnels carved in the mountains. Beautiful area. I have taken friends down there. There were stalactites hanging from these limestone walls as the sun would catch it. It was beautiful, and again, it was a place where you could catch 100 bass a day. My record was 51 big bass on 51 casts, but that was after doing a lot of figuring out where they were. The guides weren't even able to catch them, and I went down and found they were on the old river bed ledges, and it took a certain lure to get them going, and then it was Katie bar the door. I wrote the article, and unfortunately now with all the drug wars, it's impossible to go there. Then another favorite place. I love Venice, Louisiana. Red fishing, the sea trout, fabulous. Now we have the oil spill, and that's shut down. Maybe when people hear this, they're not going to want me to come fishing in their places because I've had so many places that were wonderful, and I can't go back. One of my other favorite places is Brazil. I go there in the winter and fish way back in the tributaries of the Amazon. What a fascinating place. But again, you're subject to the vagaries of the weather. And we try to time it during the dry season. Even in the dry season, I mean, the downpours that you get in the rainforest are incredible. But when the water rises up into the rainforest, and it fluctuates up to 70 feet, from dry season to wet season. When that water is up, the fish are back in the rainforest. You can't even get close to them. You have to wait till the water subsides and you can make contact with them. But the guides there are fabulous. They'll get up early in the morning. We take off when it's still dark out. They'll come to an area where you can see a lagoon back there. You know, as the rivers change and you have these big lakes. They get out of the boat and you'll swear they can't get through there. There'll be trees that big around, and they get in there with a machete and chop the way and push the boat and get you back in there, and you're fishing in a place you know no one else has ever fished. The butterflies, the birds, I mean, I can't even remember how many different hummingbirds there are there alone. It's just paradise. But I've found out, you know, through calls and checking that the conditions are perfect. Get on the plane, by the time you get down there, the rains have come for 2 days, the water's up, and it's no good. So that's always changing. But I fish little ponds, I fish public waters, I fish streams. You know, I really enjoy going to places where they say, you can't catch any fish here, and catching fish there. That's a challenge, you know. It's just like a tough golf course for a top golfer.
Biggest one you've got?
I've caught some ocean fish, you know, big cobias, 100 and some pounds, but caught peacock bass up to 23 and a half pounds, largemouth bass up to 12 and a half, smallmouth bass up to 7 pounds. I mean, just caught a walleye week before last, 29 and a half inches. I mean, but it's just the challenge of the chase. And we're always, I don't care if you caught a world record fish. That's the neat thing about fishing. Is that the biggest fish out there? No. I have a friend that caught a 10-pound, 4-ounce smallmouth not long ago. We know there are bigger ones. The world record is 11, 12. And I think we're going to break it on the Great Lakes someday soon, because the fish are really growing. The waters are being cleaned up for the most part, and there's a lot of catch and release now. People are taking care of the fishery, and that's very encouraging for the future of fishing.
When you're not doing this, what are you doing?
Well, I do a lot of programs with kids. In fact, yesterday I introduced 20 children to fishing for the first time, as young as 2 years old and as old as 10. And some of them at first, maybe their grandparents or their parents brought them, and they're, I don't want to. And by the end, you couldn't get the rods out of their hands to go get a hamburger, you know? And that's fabulous. I do a lot of that, researching, writing, fishing, traveling. It's my ideal life. I love spending time with a lot of the early manufacturers, finding out their story. And it's an ever-changing story. And I don't know what it is about fish. You know, from fishing tournaments, I know that a hot lure at one point cools off. And why is that? I mean, I went with a friend of mine, Bernie Schultz, that fishes the Elite Tour. They had a tournament down on Kentucky Lake, and I'd won a big tournament there about 20 years ago. And there were two lures that were just fabulous. And I said, Bernie, I'm really going to be able to help you here. And they didn't work. But he had some newer lures. He said, try these. And, you know, he was out fishing me like 10 to 1 with my old, very effective lures at their time. But the newer lures were better. And I liken it to tools. You could build a home today with tools from the 1850s, but the more modern tools do it faster, better. And we've evolved. We've learned a lot of things about lures that, there's just things that amaze me. I was fishing in Sturgeon Bay week before last, and there's an area where they have a lot of big smallmouth bass, but they have a real slimy moss, and you can't hardly get your lure through it. Well, I had found a little plastic cone that you could affix to the front of your lure, and it came through. I even took out a guide and a former champion of the tournaments up there, and he owns a bait shop, and he just says, I can't believe it. We've never seen anything that came through that slimy muck like this lure. And that's the fun of it. Even when I went to Ray Scott's, I came up with an adaptation of a very effective wacky worm rig using a special weedless hook and a weighted ring that went around that worm to get it down. And on a day when a guide with two anglers caught 16 fish, I caught 100.
Wow.
believe it. And that's the fun of it. And there's no 2 days that have been the same. The seasons are changing, the temperatures are changing, the water color and the water temperature, and on. There's so many factors. I don't think there's a computer program that would ever incorporate all the factors that are involved in fishing. And it's a mystery. I mean, you think these video games are challenging, or chess. Yes, they are. But nothing compares to fishing. It's a mysterious underwater world. Even with sonar, you can interpret it to a certain extent, but it's still mysterious. And sometimes you can find them on your sonar, and you can't get them to hit. In fact, I found a bay in the Sturgeon Bay area, that had 200 to 300 big smallmouth bass laying in it. And I could not figure out how to make them bite. Oh, well, I get one now and then, enough to keep me there. But someone else came along, and I think if I had the chance to do that again, I think I could catch him. I think it's a little 16th-ounce bucktail hair jig or a tiny little tube that they would have hit. Maybe they wouldn't have. But I was right there with these giant fish and couldn't get them to bite. And to me, I'm as fascinated with that as if I had gotten them to bite, you know? And it's just a mystery. It's just a puzzle that we'll never solve.
If you had to say where fishing's place was in society and its purpose, what would it be?
Well, we're fishing, it's changed, obviously, from the early times. It was survival. Now it's more recreation. But I think that's the other thing that it's important to get kids and everyone involved in fishing. Number one, it's something that you can do all your life. I go back to my class reunion, see the state, champion quarterback. Now he's on his walker, can't hardly move, and he can't play football. I can still fish. Not to put down football. I mean, it's great. I love to watch it. But by getting people involved in fishing, then they're more dedicated to making sure that we keep our waters clean, that we keep them open, we have access to them, and if we aren't careful and we lose them all to the video games and just sitting on the couch watching TV, they won't have the interest to maintain clean waters and access to our waters.
Now that you have heard from Dan himself about how he started collecting his fishing paraphernalia, we're going to take a listen to parts of his lecture he gave back on May 23rd at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum during the Hooked exhibition.
Thank you. I'm overwhelmed. Our drive up was just fabulous. I've never been to Winona before, and I can guarantee I'll be back. At one time, I thought I was doing well because they had items that went back as far as 2,000 years ago. But then someone, as I was giving Senator Cole a tour, he said, "I can't believe you don't have items older than 2,000 years." And I was almost hurt, you know, by that comment. But when he started telling me about the old copper culture, I had to add some items, and that is history. The old copper culture occurred about 8,000 years ago. You know, the glaciers came down about 11,500 years ago, and they sheared the copper formations around Lake Superior, the rock that contained them. They pushed all that down into upper Wisconsin and Michigan. And when people came along about 8,000 years ago, they're chipping away at things to make tools, and they knocked the dirt and the minerals off and found out it was a malleable metal. It was copper. And the ingenuity of those people, I'm just amazed. They made hammers out of the hardest rock in the area, the dolomite. That's the head of the hammer. And they would pound that, knock the dirt and minerals away, and make sheets of copper. From those sheets, then they could make tools. They could make knives. They could make spear points. They could make needles, weights, hooks, and gaffs. And they called those people the old copper culture. And that remained until about 3,500 years ago. Necessity, the mother of invention, right? To make these wonderful tools out of copper. We were traveling to Alaska a few years ago, and we were talking about old fishing artifacts to a man up there. And he gave us this old spear point made from a mastodon tusk. Mastodon roamed these areas. I've got pictures of them, or the remains, pictures of remains that were found less than 2 miles from my home in Warrenville, Illinois. They roamed all around these areas. And we could talk stories about that. Here's a gorge, and this was quite well-known. Native Americans would put some kind of a bait on these and use lines made out of vines. They would allow the fish to swallow it, and it would get engorged in their stomach, and they could bring the fish in. They called those gorges. And then we have a line of items here I got from a widow whose husband served in World War II, and I proudly had them on display, thinking they were Native American items, and I had a man come through an exhibit we had at a sports show, and he stopped in his tracks, and he gasped. He almost fainted. And he said, "My God, I can't believe you've got those." And I said, "Well, thank you." And he says, "You know what they are, aren't you?" And I said, "They're pretty old, aren't they?" And he said, "You're vamping. You don't know what you have." I said, "Okay, tell me." He said, "My best friend wrote his master's thesis on these. These were found on an atoll out in the Western Pacific as they were doing recon after World War II. They came across these people in Tokelau whose entire life revolved around fish. Fish was their food. It was their sport. It was their god. They worshiped fish. They made fish meal. They had every kinds of recipe of fish, from fresh fish to preserved fish. And whether it was superstition, as we fishermen are accused of being superstitious about our lures, or whether it was really true, they thought that the only effective lure for fish was made from this certain shell that was very rare in the area. And they had to dive down and use their fist like this to peer into crevices in the formations under the water to find the certain shell. And from that, they would take a sliver of turtle shell for the point and lash that to the point so that if they hooked a fish that was too big, it wouldn't break their precious lure and that they wouldn't lose it. It would just break the point off. I mean, this is creativity at its highest form. This man, it turned out, they knew of him in this master's thesis, this World War II vet, and it was all oral history that was passed down. This man had to spend a lot of time to get this information. I've got this thick thesis from him. He came along, and when he saw some of these things, he had to have them. Well, they can't, because during the funeral of their mother, their father, their child, their spouse, it was likened to the loss of one of their lures. It was called a paw, P-A. He couldn't have them, but he happened to have some flippers, snorkel, mask, and he put those on the guys, and man, they're swimming like fish, you know, and they let him have these paws, and that's what they are. We wouldn't have known. The more you share, the more you learn, and that's something I'm going to share with you today. The paws were very, very old, but they could have been up to the 1930s or 40s. Now, once they had this new technology, the flippers and the face masks and the snorkeling outfit, they wiped out the shells right away, but by then they'd made contact with the outside world, so it wasn't as critical. Many, many different ideas. Like, here's some that have mesh bodies, and they would put ground up fish meal or worms or whatever in the fish body to make a lure that had scent and would attract the fish. All kinds of creativity. And then there was a woman who lived nearby who had a fine, delicate hand and could take the skin of a porpoise and make beautiful minnows. That's some of the very early phantom minnows. And some of those then were made from bone and other materials. But we find a number of these in the area of the Mississippi River. They seem to be quite effective for walleye early on. There was a man by the name of Buell that was out fishing back in 1850. And he had a little fruit cocktail for his lunch, and he got the spoon out, and it slipped out of his hand, and it was floating through the water like that, and he saw a big pike grab it. So he went home, raided the silverware drawer, got a spoon out, and from that a whole industry was born. The earliest spoons were developed by his observation. This is a fabulous invention in 1893, the glass monotube by Welsh and Graves. I also have the original flyers, both in the envelope, sealed, and out of the envelope, open, which are very rare. Had a stamp from 1892 commemorating the 400th anniversary of Columbus sailing the ocean blue. He sent a letter addressed to the progressive fishermen, every listed post office in America. And the letter went something like this. This letter is sent to you to announce and introduce you to the latest, greatest invention in fishing. No longer will you need to remove the basic food source of the fish from the water by draining it of its minnows. You can get one minnow, put it inside this glass minnow tube, fish it all day, and then at the end of the day, after you've caught your limit, return the minnow to the water from whence it came with thanks for the capital sport it provided. If this idea catches you as it catches fish, please send me your order, $1.50 each, for the glass minotube. If it does not catch you, please pass this on to some progressive fisherman. And in the back of the sheet was a whole thing from his attorney saying, if anyone copies this, blah, 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 blah. And I just love things of that nature.
You ever tried that?
No way. Right. And not many of them exist. Oh. Until 1914, his extension of the patent went off, and then Detroit Minotubes, and everyone was copying him. But what a joke. Why would they bite something like that with a minnow inside versus right. just a bare hook with a minnow? I mean, no way. Here's some real significant baits. Number six here is the Harris Cork Frog. Very, very effective. It's made in Michigan. Only problem was, you can imagine how long it would hold up. Bang, a fish hits it and crushes it. Well, down the road, Jim Hedden had caught some good fish on the Harris frog, but they tear up. So he just got a broom handle one day and carved out a pretty close replica to that. And it caught fish just as well, but it held up. He was a beekeeper. He also published the Dowagiac Michigan newspaper. And he started giving these to some of his top customers. And the demand just grew and grew. And he called his sons together and said, boys, I think we kind of got a possible business here. His one son, W.T., was a balloon ascensionist. He'd go up in a hot air balloon and jump out with a parachute to great applause and good money. He made a lot of money. But those daredevils, a lot of them didn't live long. W.T. was careful packing his chute and lived. He said, I'll put up $1,000 if Charles will run the factory. I'll go out and test the lures and promote them. And that was the business that was built. It became the largest fishing lure business in the world. Hedden, James Hedden and sons out of Dowagiac. Whose job would you rather have? Charles running that factory or W.T. out fishing and testing lures and taking outdoor riders out fishing? Well, it caused a real rift in the family. Charles was very upset about it. He didn't speak to W.T. for many, many, many years. But I ended up with W.T.'s collection, his prototypes, and things of that nature. And it's one of many wonderful acquisitions. And it gives you a great deal of responsibility when you come up with things like that to preserve them and share them.
We want to thank Dan Basor for taking the time to interview with us and share some of his great stories of collecting the lures over the years and the history behind them.
Thanks for listening to Don't You Know? Support for this program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Don't You Know? Is produced by KQAL-FM to keep you up to date on the people, places, and events in and around Winona. Visit us online at kqal.org.